April 29th. I'm representing Kimberly, Mark, Parnell, Donnelly, and we pick up House Bill 43. You want to look and join us? We're waiting on Representative Ellis. He's got some bills. Representative Hudson? Representative Ellis is up in finance, and he asked me to take it up after. He'll be back soon, so we're going to, as soon as he gets back, I'll be happy to take it up since you're here. Last we heard about House Bill 43, there was a committee substitute was produced by the sponsor and given to us on the day of the hearing. I understand we got a new committee substitute today, about 45 minutes ago. Well, somebody, I don't imagine the committee staff had much of a chance to look at it since we just got it.
I can explain it to you very briefly, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
It is a combination of the other two bills that you have seen. It incorporates basically three elements. The first section is an intent section which expresses the legislature's intent that families shall be paid first to the greatest extent possible. The second section reverses the order of payment regarding arrearages, and that is all of the material that was contained in the original House Bill 43. The third section of the bill, and this is a new element we have added which substantially improves our fiscal note, is the establishment of an employer reporting program which allows the Child Support Enforcement Division to request employers to report the name, address, social security number of their new hires. A similar system has been working in the state of Washington, and it should dramatically increase payment of child support obligation. In the memorandum from Representative Ulmer to the committee, she outlines on the second page who must report, and it is only those employers requested to report. Only large employers who have typically employed obligors in the past will be asked, such as the University, the Municipality of Anchorage, Cars, Westmark Hotels, etc. Well over 90% of all private sector employers will not be required to report because they employ 20 or fewer employees. It is not cost-effective for the state to require reporting from small businesses. What will be reported is the name, address, and social security number of newly hired permanent employees who will work more than 350 hours during a continuous six-month period, and the employer's name, address, and employment security reference number. What CSED will do with this information is to match names with a list of obligors having child support obligations, initiate collection of child support where it is appropriate, and to destroy the employee report if no child support obligation exists. And the result will be greatly increased collection of child support obligations. Just as a note, currently CSED has 19,000 cases with child support orders, and less than 3,500 of those cases are current in their payments. The total amount of arrears outstanding at this time is $203 million. $96 million of that amount is associated with AFDC cases. The employer reporting system will enable the state to locate obligors and to collect the outstanding child support. The financial impact on the state is that the employer reporting system really is a revenue-producing program. CSED has estimated that it will collect $3 million in the first year of this, and that over $1 million of that would be revenue to the state, since essentially a third of the revenue collected would result in AFDC cases or relate to AFDC cases. So our fiscal note has been improved by that $1 million, essentially. So that's the new CS. There's the final section of the bill simply asks the Department of Health and Social Services to clearly inform applicants for public assistance that the assignment of rights to past due child support may take in those periods in which they were not on assistance. And this is something that has been a surprise to public assistance applicants after the fact. So we're asking that they explain it in language that the applicants can easily understand.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Not that I'm going to move it, I just want to discuss right now the proposed substitute. What about this? It made return as much money as possible to the families. Under what conditions will you make that decision? It seems to me the family should be involved in this, and I think under reasonable circumstances, most recipients may agree that the state needs a certain amount to operate and so on. But I want it to be done with the family's knowledge ahead of time.
The family's knowledge of the amount?
Right.
Well, that language in the bill really referenced the leeway there is in the interpretation of federal regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And so to the extent that federal regulations will allow, we are directing the state to interpret those regulations in such a way as to advantage the families.
Any other questions? Well, I thought it was a state law rather than a federal regulation that, as I understood, we've been fighting it for a couple of years, that the family gets paid first. I could tell that's not the federal regulations.
Representative Martin, through the chair, Representative Ulmer was told by the Child Support Enforcement Division last year when we considered this bill that it felt it had the leeway to do this, and it was simply a matter of interpretation of federal regulations. So we are now making this clear in statute that this is the intent of the state to interpret regulation in this way.
And also, what procedures do you have in notifying employers? I had one that called me up from another district, and he was called at the last moment. He gave an advancement to a person who worked at his place of employment, less than 20 people. And the guy asked for an advancement on his monthly pay, so the guy gave it to him, which was almost, he had to pay supposedly his hotel or home mortgage, whatever. So he paid the guy, and then the guy skipped, and then the department came and said the employer owed him money for child support. The guy didn't even know he owed child support.
Mr. Chairman, I'll defer that question to the representatives of the division that are here. I'll be better able to answer that question.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Ulmer sent any of this to the employers that it would have an impact on so that they could give some feedback on how they might see it working in their workplace?
Well, we have not as yet, since, as the chairman mentioned, this CS is very new.
Yeah.
I understand from the division that they have considerable experience with large employers and that they have cooperated very well, very positively in the past, and they can comment on that for you.
I think it'd be a good idea to at least defer them to begin with, to give them some chance to say hello, so that they don't catch them by surprise. I think that would be very helpful on the chamber site, like we talked about a few minutes ago, a couple of other areas. I was trying to think how we could assess that cost of doing this to the individual, which you really can't, after I thought about it, because some have arrearages and others don't even have kids. You know, so we're going to charge the one that doesn't even have kids just to have his name submitted.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure we can afford to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I just would like to see the employers that are going to be affected have a chance to look at it before we do anything out on the floor.
Mr. Martin?
Mr. I wonder if we could have someone from the department what procedures are to protect the employees.
Ms. Lynch, you
thank you, Representative Donnelly. I'm Ardith Lynch. I'm the Deputy Director of the Child Support Enforcement Division. The committee substitute that's before you does contain a very important addition to child support enforcement laws. Quite simply, if we want to distribute more money to the families, we have to collect more money. And we can collect more support if we have up-to-date income information. The current reporting requirements to the Department of Labor are quarterly on employers. And that may work well for the Department of Labor, but on a month-to-month child support payment, sometimes the delay in payment can be unacceptable. For example, an employee who went to work in January of this year, the employer is not required to report to the Department of Labor until the end of the quarter and 1 month beyond. So those reports are actually due to the Department of Labor tomorrow. So obviously it's not going to be until sometime in May that the Department of Labor processes those reports and gets the information to the Child Support Enforcement Division. So there can be a delay of at least 5 months before we can do income withholding on the case if we don't know the person is working. as a result, somebody who is employed short-term duration can avoid the payment of child support altogether during that period of time. It's a very important component to the income withholding requirement. We've had income withholding in effect for 5 years when support payments are more than 1 month behind. And we've made great strides in collecting child support during that period of time. Last year, 2/3 of the child support that was collected by CSED was withheld from income. During the last 4 years, voluntary payments have gone from $10 million to $12 million. And during the same 4 years, withheld payments have gone from $13 million to $23 million. So obviously, that's where the progress is to be made in collecting child support.
I don't mind you succeeding at your role. I'm worried about employers who innocently get involved and do not know an employee has an obligation for child enforcement. And therefore, they leave the job, and then the department gets back at that individual and says, hey, that fellow was working for you, so therefore you owe us 3 months of his pay. And this has happened in your area, so I'll give you the name of the employer. And it's usually the small guy, so what right, if any, does an employer have to know what the obligations are of his employees?
Thank you. The employer is not required to withhold until the employer has been notified by CSED by receipt of an income withholding order that is sent by certified mail. So until the employer receives that paperwork, they are not under any obligation to withhold. Once they do receive that paperwork, however, they aren't required to withhold income.
So if this person has a complaint that he paid without even knowing, then if he can prove that he wasn't notified, then he can get reimbursed.
Right.
Let him know. Thank you.
It's kind of hard to prove you weren't notified, isn't it?
I think any employer wants to save money.
Yeah, but people can prove that you were notified, but yeah. How would you prove you weren't notified?
Well, that's up to him then.
Yeah.
He said he had no choice. He had no idea that I owed money.
Are there any other questions for this witness? Representative
Hedge? Yeah, just on a technical question on this. It says upon notice by the agency, the employer shall notify the agency the hiring of a person. So, it says normally, do these people say, I'm going to go apply for a job, so then the agency will send out a notice to that person? I mean, it seems like it would happen the other way around.
Best source of information is through the Department of Labor records, and there is an inherent delay in using those records. In the past, we have had some success with voluntary reporting by employers. For example, during the oil spill cleanup, NORCON and VECO agreed to voluntarily provide CSED with computer tapes of the employees that were working on the oil spill cleanup, which we matched with our records, and we collected over $500,000 of child support through that mechanism. And that is the same type of mechanism that we would anticipate using this way. It's not to the agency's benefit to get information that we can't use. So we would target the employers that have a history of employing obligors, especially in seasonal or short duration jobs, that so that we can collect the child support when the person is working and has the ability to support their children.
And that, you may want to, it says, shall report the hiring of a person, and that implies to me that you have, they're anticipating hiring rather than the employment of a person, which means they're currently employed. And I don't know if that, because both of these talk about the rehiring or return to work or initial hiring, like if somebody gets to work while they're currently working, maybe a technical change.
If they're currently working, we're probably getting the information from the Department of Labor already. What we want to do is cut down that time delay in getting that information. And that can be provided to us at least in one of two ways, either through a computer match, which most large employers probably are capable of doing, or just through sending us a copy of a W-4 form for that employee. We want to make it as easy on employers as possible to provide that information. And it's, so it's not to our benefit to require employers that don't typically hire a lot of obligors. We do have records for the last 3 years, and one example that I can give you is several hospitals in Alaska, which are among the larger employers, have only hired one or two obligors during the last 3 years. So obviously we don't want information from them because we would get too much bad information for the small amount of good information that we could get.
On your 350-hour limitation there that you have in line 31 of page 2, why was it put in there? Who is that to address?
That's, let's see if I can do my mental arithmetic. That would exclude people who work, I think, less than 15 hours a week. So just people that are, you know, working on like student-type part-time jobs.
What about someone who hires out on a fishing boat for a couple of weeks and makes $40,000? Then they don't, they're excluded, is what it sounds like.
That's true.
Yeah.
Consider a change there. This portion of the committee substitute was patterned off the Washington state reporting law.
And if somebody's working full-time and they snag another second job for an extra 15 hours a week, that lets them out too. So I see a little difficulty in 350 hours. Thank you.
Well, I'll wait at some point. I have some questions.
Yeah, I can see. Well, this probably is the point.
This is the point?
Yeah.
Okay. Two questions. Maybe I could ask this to the representative of the sponsor.
Sure, you want to speak there? There's a lawyer in the bank. We have a list to proceed today.
We'll do what I can to make more
sure. Thank you so much.
First of all, two questions. Is it necessary to have a findings of intent section? Normally we don't. That's very unusual. I don't see any particular reason that section.
Well, the reason that we included this was that, as you can tell, this bill has dropped out a great deal, most of the bill that we were promoting last week. We received more information from the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement, which indicates to us that the litigation that was ongoing in Washington and that affects the interpretation of federal regulations is skewing at this point towards the federal interpretation, federal government side. But that the outcome of that case is not clear at this point. And so we feel there are probably quite a few changes in the offing, and that we wanted to make clear what the intent was so that the state would be able to go forward with that intent in the light of future developments. So that was really the reason for putting that in there.
I think that the agency is going to know what the intent is. We're dealing with one agency, unless there's a real serious reason to strike action. The second thing is page 3, line 23. And I'll just continue to read that. The notice must be in a language reasonably understandable by the applicant. I assume we're not talking about ancient Latin. How about if we just said the notice must be in plain English?
That sounds good.
Well, okay. Are you going to be printing it in some other language?
There may be a barrier. One to just leave it open, understood by the individuals.
You're going to have people who say, "I don't read English. You've got to print it for me," and you name it, I'll say it.
Just because I say that about your bills doesn't mean the others.
See, that's a good court case in point. I only print them in English. I think I'll make that motion.
Any comments?
The intent was simply to make sure that the applicant clearly understood. And you know, obviously the language is an important element there.
Nobody else has signed up to testify, so we're ready for amendments.
Yeah, but seriously, on that point, isn't there time that you will come up with people with foreign language, and maybe someone would write it out, even an assistant that knows their language, so they can understand that? I'm worried about it being saying English.
Okay, but I understand. Let's ask the agency what they think.
This section actually pertains to the Department of Health and Social Services for public assistance recipients, not to the Child Support Enforcement Division.
Is there anyone else here? But what do you think? Do you think we should just say, must be, we could say, must be in language reasonably understandable by the applicant? However, then you're going to have some sharp lawyer, and I will say who it might be, say, this is not reasonably understandable, and then that's the question of this litigation.
And that's a two evil if you nail yourself down to this English.
Why don't we say, must be, the notice must be plainly written, clearly written. I'll make the motion, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, first of all, I'll make a motion that we have the CS before us.
Sure. Any objection to that?
We have no objection. The CS is before us. And the motion is to amend page 3, line 23, to read how?
The notice must be plainly written.
Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, that amendment passes.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move to strike section 1.
Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, the motion carries.
I think it's weaker, though.
Anybody want to do anything else?
I'd like the employers to get a copy of it and to sign up on it before it hits the floor. And I think that's possible. But you have a list of them, you know who they're going to go to, primarily, the large employers, if you can get their impressions back. This has one more stop, finance?
Looks like finance.
So maybe between here and finance, you can get the lion's share response from them so that, you know, they may come up with something totally different that is even better. So they may have a red flag on a section of it, especially on their requirement for reporting. Pardon me?
Small employers getting better.
Well, yeah, 20 or below don't get hit with it, I understand. Is that correct?
Yes, we would only require employers with a large number of obligors to report.
To report by for payment. Any employer.
We would not. Right.
Yes.
We'll make the modification. But I'd appreciate it if we could kind of have an agreement on getting feedback from them before it gets out of the next committee.
Sure, it's a request to the sponsor. Okay. Representative Groomberg?
Just a typographical error. Page 2, line 29. Month should be apostrophe. Not S apostrophe.
1 month. That's true. Okay, noted. For the committee substitute. That's a little
question. Yeah, she had just mentioned there was an exemption for people under 20, employing under 20, or that was their intent, and I didn't see it.
There is no exemption in the bill, but the where the number 20 employees comes in is from information regarding employers in Alaska. Over 90% of the employers, the number of employers in Alaska employ fewer than 20 employees. So we not only have the division telling us that, first of all, they're going to go to large employers, but within that group, which we know is less than 10% of the total number of employers in Alaska, they are going to be asking and looking to those employers which not only employ a great number of employees, but of those employees, they have historical data that shows a great number of obligors falls within their employee group. So we have a very small segment of the employer market represented here. And there are no exceptions or exemptions in the bill, but it is not to the division's benefit to ask for lots of information and just bar themselves down. It gives them the latitude to request information from those, to target those employers that will yield the information they need.
Representative Groomberg?
This may have been a question that was already asked. Page 3, lines 17 and 18, subsection G. The civil penalty is not more than $1,000. It would seem to me that normally, if somebody failed to report when they knew they had to report, and as a result, the obligee lost a certain amount of child support, that the person who failed to report would be liable for the amount of lost child support. That would be the damage. Now, we're talking about the employer or union who knowingly refused to report, knowingly violated that section. I assume that you're mainly talking about somebody who knew that they were supposed to report on Joe Obligor and refused to do that. The quantum of damages would normally be the amount of the lost child support. Not a set amount, and I wonder if any thought had been given to that. That seems to me the most fair level of damages.
To the chair, I certainly appreciate the point. I'd have to defer that to, in terms of the equity of the issue, that we have not given any consideration to.
Because $1,000 may be too high, conceivably could be too low, but it seems to me that at least technically, would be the amount of back child support.
If I may respond to that, the penalty for an employer who does not respond to a withholding order is the amount of the withholding order, the amount of unpaid child support. Subsection F and subsection G currently exist in statute, which is reporting information to CSED. The current statute reads that upon request of the agency, employer, or labor union must notify us or provide information. And the penalty that's currently in the statute is $1,000.
Well, then that doesn't change my question. On the merits, what's your response?
The response is that an employer who does receive a withholding order and doesn't respond, you know, is liable for the full amount of the withholding order. I can see that the, you know, similar analogy here when an employer has an obligation to report and doesn't report.
Do you have the language that we would insert?
I'm trying to think. There's another statute that speaks to employer or civil liability for an employer's failure to respond to a withholding order. So perhaps that section could be amended to include.
If we could take a minute, would you be able to look that up?
Mm-hmm.
May I make a suggestion?
Well, why
I'm looking at section F, which starts on page 3, line 14, and it says, an employer who is not notified to report employee hiring, should that be an employer who is notified?
I believe subsection F was written to address those employers who aren't required to report all new hires to CSED, but who would be still required to respond to an individual request for an individual obligor. So they're not required to report under subsection A, but they're still required to provide requested information.
Okay, and then going directly to Representative Greenberg's question on subsection G, is that a civil penalty in the way of a fine that would be in addition to damages that would be suffered by the person as a result of not getting the amount withheld by the employer? I mean, it seems to me that as I read this, it's like we have criminal penalties, we have civil fines, and in addition, and some kind of civil action, and maybe actual damages that can be assessed.
And if I may, if that's the intent, then we should say this is in addition to other damages. I think it should be clarified one way or the other. I had one time had that question, and then I assumed that it was the opposite. What is the intent? You said that's an existing one. Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't know that there was intent to change the existing provision of the law.
What is the existing provision? Is this in addition to the damages?
I believe, yes, because it's a civil penalty to the state.
So it's in addition?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I think that we should have clarifying language added.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm kind of with you on that one, since the council said in line 14, said an employer who is not notified to report blank. Shall upon request. So either you've been notified or you've been requested. It seems like a double talk there.
Ms. Otto asked the same question. Yeah. Ms. Lynch just answered. Maybe she
didn't
repeat what you said.
And I heard what you said, but I still felt we should make it shorter. Upon request, an employer shall.
Yeah, it was kind of confusingly written in my point of view, too. I think that we should redraft that to make it clearer.
Okay.
And I think that we should. I would make a conceptual amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
That staff redraft subsection F to be clear.
Yeah.
this goes along with your previous amendment, that it should be clear and understandable by people.
Right. We'll call that the Martin Gruber concept.
Being consistent, plainly written.
Plainly written.
Martin concept.
And then the sub G, that language be added in sub G to make it clear that that's in addition to the other damages.
Okay. Any objection to those conceptual amendments?
No, no, no. It's on that point that I'm going to ask you to have lawyer.
Can we go ahead and adopt those?
Sure.
Okay, all right. Motion carries. Representative Martin.
You two had lawyers, so I didn't want to rely on more than anything else. We seem to be making the employer the collecting agency. Mm-hmm. And of all the burden they have just trying to break even in life. And at the same time, suppose a small company, more than anything else, seems to me to get phoned with these kind of people. somehow, however, I'm found to be negligent. If they are negligent, I think that just the mere fact that they were trying to help someone or the agency pay this guy's bill, they should not be punished in addition to it, whether it be paying interest or paying $1,000 fine, as you said, but maybe just that cost for that, at the most, just the cost for that month. After being notified.
If I can respond, this, and I'm not sure I'm answering your question. This requires that the violation be a knowing one.
Mm-hmm.
But that may not be enough. You may want to raise it to some kind of an intention or something. But I just would point out that the word knowing is in there.
Well, I don't want them to be fined anymore. It's bad enough that they have to. We insist that they hire whoever comes without any discrimination whatsoever, and suddenly finds, and I've seen the guy go through this trouble. He didn't know whatsoever. It cost him all kinds of trouble having feelings and trying to prove the guy done left. You know, I paid him early advancement, and he dealt with all the costs of his agency, even the agency here of bringing him in, calling him, and coming to the place of employment. He just paid him to the heck with to get out. I'll be more careful about hiring that.
Maybe I
didn't
ask
Ms.
Lynch to.
Well, I believe that an employer reporting requirement could potentially save some employers from unnecessary paperwork, because in the example that I gave you earlier of somebody who went to work in January and CSED doesn't find out until May, that employee could be long gone by the time the employer gets the withholding order. So if we know we're getting current information for that employee, we can issue a withholding order if it's appropriate, and so the employer is not going to be getting withholding orders from us long after the employee has terminated his employment. It actually can help the employer tailor the paperwork that they get from us to be most productive for both the employer and for the agency.
I had the guy call you up.
Okay, so one of the thoughts of the committee, we've amended it now. We worked on Attorney General Cole's confirmation tomorrow, and we've got a full week.
My suggestion would be if we could have this brought back as the first order of business tomorrow, took literally 2 minutes to look at the language. Since we're just asking them to redraft this, I think we want to be sure we can. Or at least just before you give it to the clerk, you don't even have to take it up tomorrow. Just since they can't read it across until Wednesday anyway, at least have a copy of the CS at our places tomorrow. So just take a look at it and then you have it.
Sure, maybe we'll do one of those two.
But I think whatever we want to see what
fits. Whatever fits. Okay. So
I don't have a problem with passing that, as long as the clerk doesn't physically get it.
Well, the one good reason to pass it out now is that if we don't have a quorum or something tomorrow, we can show it to the people who are interested in it. Keep the front rolling.
Still has to go to finance?
Yeah. But we want to be sure that this is written.
So, okay. All right, so there's a motion to move the bill with individual recommendations. Any objection?
As amended?
Yeah, as amended.
We're with the understanding that a copy will be put on the desk.
Well, the last amendment I got was that Eldred was an F and G.
Yeah, what we said was F will be rewritten more clearly, and G will be rewritten to say this is $1,000 in addition.
Any objection to the motion? Hearing no objection. increase is from 146, but Representative Gruenberg,
yeah,
and
Representative
Barnes were supposed to get the
other. I owe people an apology, and I did not have a chance to bring my hearing. I can't go from Norway, I will go from the board. It was not an attempt to, but there were any additional problems.
Is there anybody from Representative Barnes' office here? Well, looking at the calendar, Friday probably our next best chance to take a shot at this.
Absolutely, we will promise.
Which one is that night?
That's the 146.
You know, in thinking about 146, I do think there's some middle ground here.
There definitely is, and it's a question of having the chair.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Bring that to Mark.
What was the question?
When 1024, did we move this here to committee substitute? I was wondering who had that. Was this done in connection with what you were talking about?
Is that on 146?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think we've adopted a committee substitute.
No.
Did you? When
will we?
Mr. Chairman, what happened is Representative Gruenberg asked on 146 whether or not it amended a court rule, and we posed the question to the drafters. After they looked at it, they on their own sent over a CS because they believed that it did amend a court rule and the failure to include that was a drafting error on their part, and there's a memo that went along with the CS.
Okay, and then 424 is the current status way we're at now.
Well, we have not adopted it. It was something that was sent over by the drafters.
Right, that's the latest.
Because they believed that he didn't have a court rule change.
Okay.
I see. Okay. Well, then I'm going to hold it over till Friday. That should give us three full working days.
That's ample.
And because we've got the Attorney General tomorrow, we've got the revisor's bill on Wednesday, which could be, walk me through that. Could take quite a bit of
time. You might put that aside.
Well, I think it makes more sense just to walk through it so people know what's in it. Because when it comes to the floor, then there are people knowing what's in it, what do you think? Okay, so we'll hold 146 over until Friday. 101 we're going to hold over until Wednesday on the record, just for that. And we're up to 196, but Representative Ellis is testifying in finance, and we should be down here in a couple minutes. I know I wanted to ask the committee. Oh, Representative Barnes brought a problem to my attention just before the committee meeting. Apparently on Thursday or Friday, the Supreme Court upheld a law that took the eligibility of convicted felons away on permanent fund dividends. And the question has arisen.
So they reversed the Superior Court?
Yes, they did. They reversed Judge Cohen. And now the question emerges, what will be printed on people's checks? Because it wasn't printed last year because all the money was going into a fund off to the side somewhere. So now that money will be, the way the statute is now, it would show up on their checks as being deducted again. And Representative Barnes has asked me if I would ask the committee if they'd be introducing to doing a little fine-tuning of that recording statute to explain to people that we're really not taking any money away from them. It's money, it's just an extra amount they would receive because the pool is smaller. The number of people in the pool is smaller by the number of incarcerated felons. But the way the statute's drafted now, it appears as a deduction. So now we're really not reducing people's checks. Mm-hmm. We're just saying that the money that would have gone to the felons is going someplace else. But because of the way it reduced the number of people, it appears as a deduction. And I said to her that I'd bring it up to the committee too. She's working on a draft.
I think what we can do is what we did last year, and that's what caused the commissioner at the very last minute. You notice when last year did it check, you had two lines of deduction, then all of a sudden they put asterisks over them. That's because we called up and I wanted to find out how much was being taken out of the checks, and did they evaluate the letter of intent that legislators signed, saying that if it would not, we made it clear, if the court says that this was not proper, it would not be taken out. Well, they'd already made their own decision and took the money out. And so they just covered it all up. The checks were already printed. So I think by letter of intent, rather than mess up your checks, you can show that nothing is being taken out. And when things struggle, well, that's appropriate. Matter of fact, that $5 million goes back to general fund, that goes to different fund.
Well, yeah, it goes to the general fund and is used for three things.
Right.
Which I've always had concerns with, because I always felt the money should totally go to what the bill said, and that was the victim's compensation program. But it goes to gate money and the sex offender treatment program also, which means only about half of it goes to the victims.
Well, I think, as they did before, and as I say this time here, through the 11 and 10, we gave the Department of Revenue a message, and they can still do that for the victims of crime, for the whole harmless and the provision, without putting it on a check, because they're not taking out the checks anymore.
Well, yeah, but the problem is, I think they're telling us unless we amend the statute, they're going to put it on the checks that way as a deduction.
Because it's already in the statute.
Right, yeah.
So they can't change it without another statute.
Exactly.
Or that of intent.
So what I'm doing now is raising it to the committee, asking, it's a request from Representative Barnes, and it seems like it would be a thing we could do as a committee bill, and she's asking it. So if the committee...
Sure, either that or, Mr. Chairman, since we're getting so close to the end of the session, either it be a committee bill that we, since we introduced it, could ask that it not be referred to the committees at the same point in time, or if she wants to show it to us, she could put it in and informally run it by us, and we still waive it in the committee. And otherwise, it would come.
You gotta have one hearing, right?
Well, I assume it'd go to finance.
Not really.
So we only ask for one.
Yeah, we can bring it here, have a hearing, kick it on its way as fast as possible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You need to write a letter to Ben, copy your name, just to approve.
Okay. And she actually asked me to see if I'd waive the 5-day rule, and I said, well, that's pretty questionable. I'd much rather just try to expedite it as fast as possible.
You need also to check with Representative Green, so that we can stay here.
Well, have both. I'd still like to have a letter of intent, because that's what worked before. That's what started Tom Williams, or, once we called up.
Well, Representative Martin, could you talk to Representative Barnes about your idea? Would you be willing to do that?
Do both of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, then I'll take it that the committee's interested in this, and that's a good suggestion about Representative Covina, because that's probably a more appropriate committee, but I don't...
Yeah.
Maybe I should go talk to him also. And
he shouldn't have any problem. I would be happy to talk to him. Yeah. It's a technical thing.
Right.
Revenues can give you language real quick.
Let me ask a question. Maybe you could check with Dave Dierdorf and see if we could stick it in the revisers. It's really a technical thing as a result of this court case.
We do have the revisers bill on the calendar for Wednesday.
I think it's appropriate for you.
Boy, that would be a way to get it through fast.
Why
don't we go off record here for just a few minutes? go over to Senator Halford and ask him if he concurs, and if he concurs and we do the same thing, then we could do it, maybe.
Just comply with the Supreme Court with his decision.
Right.
Let's go back on the record.
Okay, you want to go back on the record, Sheila? Well, we know what we're trying to do. Okay, so the matter before us is whether or not a revision to conform the law regarding checks of convicted incarcerated felons to the Supreme Court decision and the intent of the legislature not having that appear as a deduction of people's checks would be a technical matter that could be placed within the revisers more appropriately. And I'd make a motion that it is, that the committee make a finding that it is a technical matter that would be appropriate in the revisers bill to be forward to legal as a finding of the Judiciary Committee.
Do you want somebody else to actually look at it?
Do you want to make that motion?
So.
Okay. I guess all members understand the motion before us. Mm-hmm. Is there any objection to the motion? Okay, hearing no objection, that's the official position of the committee. And then we'll forward that letter and we'll also correspond or communicate with the Senate Judiciary Committee and Secretary. All right. Please go back off record. So. The House Bill 196 at this time.
I was somewhat concerned, and I may not be alone, as to some of the testimony we heard when we last heard this bill on the antitrust aspects of this whole thing. And I am fairly concerned about the allegations that that there may have been or may be ongoing antitrust violations on the part of certain companies in this state with respect to the pipeline system. And I'm glad to see you've been joined by that.
Representative Hudson, if you might just sit with us, sure. Because we might have other witnesses come up. I'm sorry, but Representative Miller's ankle is gone, so he's not here today, so
All right. You're
welcome to join us there.
I didn't mean to break his ankle.
You need to vote on how many is that?
Okay.
I'm glad we've been joined by the oil and gas chair. And I'd like to make a suggestion. I am very concerned, and I know that the representative has also been concerned about antitrust applications in the past, the price of the gasoline. That's not what we're talking about here, but we're talking about the allegations involved in this. But I'd like to make a request to the two chairs that either the committee or both committees jointly have an oversight here on the issue of possible antitrust violations of the operation of the pipeline in this area with the shipping. And without any specific legislation in front of us, I don't think it's necessary to do that at this point, but with the view of the possible introduction of appropriate legislation, what we have to do. I'd like to frankly suggest, since it's within the purview of both committees, that we make it a joint hearing.
If Chairman Hudson was interested in that, we could do something on the interim on that.
I'm thinking before the interim, at some time of mutual means. I think we should do it sooner rather than later. I am really concerned about this.
I don't know if we got too much time, Max, I don't know how much we can get done. We had talked about this, numbers have been talking about we need more information about what is going on in that whole trade situation, and an oversight hearing would certainly provide us an opportunity to bring some of that up.
I'm saying we're talking about a couple of hours. I certainly think in the next 20 days or however many days we have, things could find a couple of hours.
We have to be on the other side.
Well, we're not talking, are we, Mr. Chairman, of withholding any action on this legislation pending that. We're just talking about a separate function.
Yes.
And I could certainly agree with that. Why don't I get together with Chairman Donnelly, and maybe we can set up a time, Dave, when we can hold a couple of hours and just find out what's going on there from that extent.
All right. Take a look at it. I don't know who we've got that knows much about antitrust law.
There are some people around here, but at least we got the facts.
Okay. Well, maybe if you had some suggestions, Representative Greenberg, on who, you know, who could lend us some help in that area, or would be good people to have testify, I'd sure appreciate it.
Maybe I can get together with the staff. I wouldn't know where to start
to put it together. You know?
I think the staff of the two committees and me and my staff can get us some of the witnesses.
Okay. Mark?
I'm kind of like you. I understand in law school you have a whole semester on this, but you want us to do it in 2 hours?
And not all of us take that.
It's an elective.
That's your family.
Boy. I took tax law. Okay, well, we're on House Bill 196. We have a little discussion of possibly having a joint meeting of oil and gas sometime in the future on antitrust issues generally with the pipeline, not directly related to 196.
We were talking specifically the allegations of shipping.
Right.
Yeah.
And we've been joined by Representative Ellis, and so I guess I'll give you a second to collect your thoughts here. I guess where we left this, Representative Grunberg and Representative Ellis had concerns. And one of the opportunities to discuss with the sponsor and other legislators matters concerning House Bill 196, and I understand there may be proposed amendments that may be prepared, so I just put it open for general discussion.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm sorry, I apologize to members of the committee. I had a bill, a tax bill, I think, for the Finance Committee, and needed to be there. I did have several from the last public hearing had several concerns, and I'll try and go through those and put them on the record. The first had to do with having time to examine the bill about the chain of, we're reducing the liability standard, and I was interested in making sure that limitation on liability didn't extend back up the chain of people involved in responding to discharges of hazardous materials, and that isn't the case. There's no change necessary in this version of the bill, in my opinion. It's only the person responding to the spill that's released for 15 days from, or removed a notch in the liability standard. So I had time to research that, and I appreciate that consideration. The other concern, the second of three, had to do with from the testimony we received from Tesoro, you know, the amount of oil that's moved back and forth from Valdez to their refinery on the peninsula, and all the mitigation safety techniques that they've done, the double hull on their transport, and the other safety precautions they've taken, all seem to me justification of something less than $1 billion direct action bond. To me, that seems like such a difficult thing for a company worth $200 million as Tesoro is to come up with. And current Alaska law allows for the so-called P&I clubs to pool essentially for the kind of liability coverage that, you know, under that kind of arrangement, it could still be for $1 billion, and Tesoro would have the coverage, and Alaska would have the peace of mind to know that they would get paid up to the same amount, $1 billion, but maybe it wouldn't happen as quickly as if there were a direct action bond, money sitting there ready to pay them off. And it just seemed, you know, that just struck me as not reasonable on the part of Alyeska. I have an amendment prepared here that I'd like to share with folks that addresses this issue. And I also have copies of the current statute where it allows for pooling of liability. This seems like a real concrete way of helping out Tesoro here, and that's what we're all trying to do with this legislation. Keep everybody in business, bring some reason to the what's being demanded of them here, and I think this would would get us there. I mean, if we're talking about doing something concrete for Tesoro, I think this gets us a lot closer than the bill as it currently exists in the committee substitute. And on the question of whether this is, you know, legal or constitutional for us to do this, to some people call this interfering in a contract or whatever, I've received, there were several objections raised to it. I didn't quite get all of them, but Mr. Chairman, I've requested from Mike Ford, our legislative counsel, I asked him whether there are any constitutional problems with the above-referenced amendment to this bill, the one that you're looking at. This amendment allows a person who contracts with an oil spill response action contractor to show financial responsibility using any of the forms allowed by AS 4604-040E. The amendment does not apply to existing contracts. And his short answer is that while the amendment requires examination under due process provisions, it does not appear to be unconstitutional under those or other provisions of the federal or state constitutions. So it goes on from there, and I'd like to, it's pretty brief though, and I'd like to provide that to members of the committee as well.
So basically, this would not apply to any existing contracts. It would only apply to future contracts entered into. And I guess one of the questions we could ask is how long is the current contract period?
I believe it's over in June. Didn't we hear testimony previously that June is the when it's all over?
June. It works pretty good.
I guess I'd like to move this as amendment number one and get some comments from anyone who would care to comment about, doesn't this really help Tesoro if we decided to do this?
Okay, so the amendment's been moved and is before us and ready for public comment. And, is there anybody in particular that would like us to comment? Representative Gruber?
Just, I'm going to make a conceptual concern. I would appreciate it if, since I do have some questions about this, the new section as well, I'm wondering if we can broaden that in any way. I'd ask that I have no objection to the rest of it. I'd ask if we could divide the question, because I'm going to, or maybe I'm premature. I do want to have some discussion on this. No. I think what you have here is great. I'm just wondering whether we can do anything that will have any effect on contracts that are already. So, and of course, everybody's immediately says no.
We don't want to.
And then I had a question. In the original bill, for example, we've got a sunset clause, and this doesn't seem like something we would want under the sunset clause. It seems like this would be a permanent private statute.
If we decided to do this, I would request that it not be under the one-year sunset. It's currently in the committee substitute.
Okay.
I mean, if we think this is a good idea, we ought to do it, and it ought to be, I think, for more than this. But, you know, whatever, I'll go with the rule.
Okay. So, just a,
Mr. Chairman.
We need to come back to that if we do. Okay. Representative Hudson.
Yes. I think I've also passed out a letter from Michael Ford, legislative counsel, on essentially the same thing. It is a little bit different, I think, as far as the drafting is concerned. And I would just ask that the maker of this amendment and others take a look at paragraph 3 of Mr. Ford and Ms. Pickerensen's.
Okay, do we have that? I don't think
that
we
have that. Okay. And might I, Mr. Chairman, if I might explain it, I had also considered this type of an approach and had gone to the legislative drafters to essentially draft something, and it really was almost identical to what Representative Ellis is putting out. But in his transmittal to me, he has a further explanation of why he believes that it would not work, and I would just simply like the all members here to at least observe Mr. Ford's remarks in that instance as well, because I think it applies equally to the amendment you have before you, as well as the one that I had in draft for me. And the reason I didn't present it before was primarily because of that language, as well as the testimony that we received from several of the witnesses here last time we met. So. I think you need to listen to both.
And Mr. Chairman, the reason I appreciate those comments, and the reason I'm offering the amendment is because Mr. Ford told me my amendment would work and doesn't have a constitutional problem. The I guess the logical extension, if for some reason we can't do amendment number one, that, you know, there are objections to that and that's a problem, and people don't see it as the way to really help DeSoro, which Representative Navarro has asked me to do what I can to get over my problem of reducing Alaska's liability laws in the case of hazardous discharges. And that's what I'm trying to do, is get over this, the things to help DeSoro and the things that, like the one-year sunset, that give us a chance to redo it again, so that I can feel like it's okay to reduce our liability laws in this case, in the post-Exxon spill era aftermath when everybody's tense. So that's what I'm trying to do here, and Mr. Ford told me this is fine. I guess if that doesn't work, what you get to is Representative Navarro's suggestion that he's made before, to have separate legislation that would make Alyeska the rack for the entire Prince William Sound. Doesn't it make good public policy sense to have one contingency plan rather than a myriad of contingency plans for the same body of water, and just say that Alyeska is, designate them as the response action contract? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're handling our oil and their oil, and it's a, seems like a compelling state interest to simplify things and make that happen. So this is sort of an intermediate, intervening kind of thing between where we are now and that effort, which I would imagine Alyeska would have some concerns about, being designated as a response action contractor, the contingency plan holder for Prince William Sound. So I'm not trying to change the world, I'm trying to fix this problem, I guess, with the amendment.
Okay.
This references an amendment by Andy.
It references, Mr. Chairman, it references an amendment that was along the same lines but different, and that's what my suggestion would be, is that if Mr. Ford is here, to see what is substantially different, because maybe Representative Ellis has found a solution that we did not find in our first approach, and I respect and appreciate...
Want, is he here? Somebody wanted here?
I guess we'll call and ask him to come over if you want. Mm-hmm.
Jim. Well, Mr. Chairman, perhaps there's another, somebody else here.
I've got a question.
Could,
sure. Okay. Well, we'll call Mr. Ford and ask him that question. And maybe to save time, or we can even hook him up on the speakerphone.
Representative Hudson, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If he can run all this.
Representative Hudson, did you want to finish?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would just simply like to suggest that, you know, I'm not an attorney, and if this works, then that's really fine. But perhaps you would entertain the idea of perhaps having DeSoro come before us.
Oh, of course.
And really see how they would respond to this, and see what, if it works, and if it satisfies, and if it will force Alyeska to provide the services at a reasonable cost, then that's all right with me.
Okay. Representative Groomberg?
I'm going to play a devil's advocate here a little bit. One thing does concern me. The way this is written is that the contract between the response action contractor and the shipper that requires the person to demonstrate financial ability to respond to the RAC in damages must provide that the person may demonstrate financial responsibility under subsection E. Subsection E says financial responsibility may be demonstrated by self-insurance, insurance, surety, guarantee, etc., and letter of credit approved by the department, or other proof of financial responsibility approved by the department. Now, I have no problems with the language that is in sub 5 and 6, approved by the department, but I can see some shipper coming up and saying, hey, I'm self-insured, guys, and I have enough money here, and here's my balance sheet prepared by my sharp accountants. And also, I have a guarantee letter from my granny. And under the way this is drafted, you'd have to accept that. It doesn't have any language like approved by the department or something like that. And let's say we have Joe Shady, who is the contractor here, who waves these things around and says, I have my guarantee by my granny and my own financial statement. Then it seems to me that they're obligated to accept that without any independent approval or anything by the department or anything else.
And I could see us being in a reverse situation from the present set of facts, where you've got somebody who demands that they accept this, and then we get into a situation and it really, the whole house of cards comes tumbling down. And if we're not careful, this could turn around, and the opposite set of facts could cause us, this divide us in the rear in the future.
Are you there, Mike?
I'm here.
Okay, we're on House Bill 196, Mr. Ford, and there's a couple questions were raised. Representative Grunberg's finishing raising a question here, but then we'll be right to you.
Okay.
Mike, this is Max Grunberg. I don't know if you heard at the beginning. What I'm concerned about is that the wording of the amendment, which contains the word must provide that the person may demonstrate financial responsibility, that would help in this circumstance, but in a circumstance where the shipping company didn't have those kinds of assets, it would obligate the response action contractor to accept that. Oh, is there something here?
Yeah, Mr. Ford, we're on...
But 5 and 6 contain the language.
Can I explain some?
I'm sorry.
I just want to... Mr. Ford, we're on... Representative Ellis has proposed an amendment to the CS, House Bill 196 Judiciary.
Right.
And it's the 424 version. And I just wanted to make sure he knew what we were referring to. I'm sorry. Yeah. Representative Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the Chairman said, we have the amendment that you prepared for me, Mike, and your legal opinion that there were no constitutional problems or any problems you could see with that. Representative Hudson made the point earlier in the meeting that he had the same interest that I had and had a similar amendment prepared previously by you and an opinion from you that probably wouldn't work. So he's a little puzzled now that, you know, what's the difference in the amendments and why were there some concerns with his and you don't have the same concerns with mine? Are we making progress in trying to figure out what's doable and good public policy at the same time? Could you clear that up for us?
Sure. There's different approaches between the Hudson Amendment and Amendment J.2. And the problems that I pointed out as far as Representative Hudson's amendment mainly dealt with the fact that you can impose this requirement, but that doesn't mean that you're going to find people that are willing to enter into an agreement under those provisions. So they weren't constitutional problems as much as they are practical problems. Now, that same issue would apply to this amendment, Representative Ellis' amendment as well. There are no constitutional issues, and that was a question posed to me as far as doing this. But, I think there are some practical concerns as far as the people who enter into a contract under these terms. So, again, as far as from a constitutional or legal viewpoint, I think you can take either approach, and they are different approaches. One is a bonding approach. And the approach taken in J.2 is simply to provide that they can demonstrate financial ability to respond in any of the forms specified in 4604 or 40E, which is a different issue than the bonding approach in Representative Hudson's amendment.
Do we have Representative Hudson's amendment?
We don't have it.
I guess
we can do that. Okay. Representative
Grunberg. I without taking a position, since we haven't seen Representative Hudson's amendment, I think, and Representative Ellis has shown me the language in subs 5 and 6 in subsection E that have the caveat approved by the department. One way of curing my question would be if we decide to go the Ellis approach as opposed to the Hudson approach, would just be after the word section and before the period to add the following clause, comma, if the financial responsibility is approved by the department, period. That would make certain that there would be somebody there who would independently look at it and make certain that they really do have the financial ability here. And that would probably technically cure it. But probably, Mr. Chairman, we probably want to look at the Hudson Amendment before we get into the details. If we take the Ellis approach, that would be the kind of thing I think that.
Representative, can you just restate that?
Yeah.
Where you're looking at.
Yeah. Okay. I'm looking at the new sub D, and the second to the last line says under that section period, and between the word section and the period, a possible language would be comma, if the financial responsibility is approved by the department.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I can point out one thing.
Mr. Ford.
Under O4LE, one of the forms allowed is a form approved by the department. And I don't have any problem with that language, other than the fact that it would be redundant of that provision. We already have language which says, if the department approves the form of financial responsibility, then that is acceptable. And that is why we use the reference to O4LE.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I may. That's true for subs 5 and 6, Mike, but it doesn't, if they, the way the thing is drafted now, somebody could come up with self-insurance guarantees and stuff that don't have to be approved by the department. I want to make certain that they can't skate out under that. Subs 1 through 4. You follow me?
I do, and I'm looking at that right now.
Because I would not think statutorily, and that may, frankly, be a drafting problem in present sub E. I don't know why it doesn't say now, I'm not familiar with the statute, but why it doesn't have a requirement that any of those must be approved by the department or something, but you can get a guarantee from anybody. In fact, the less solvent, the more easy your guarantee is going to be to get.
Well, in that sense, I guess I agree with Representative Bloomberg. We want to have the department have the final authority on this.
Okay, well, maybe we can just put this question behind us. If nobody objects, I'll take that as a motion. Is there any objection to adding that language, amending the amendment to insert that language? Okay, without objection, then the amendment is amended, and we're back to the main amendment. Is that okay, Representative Gruber?
Sure. I just a question, really, to Mr. Ford, if I may.
Okay.
And at some point, you may want to look at subsection E and to see why that wasn't in 1 through 4 as well as 5 and 6. I don't know, but I'm not about to get into that unless I know now.
Okay. Representative Ellis.
I just had a question about to Mike about Representative Hudson's amendment. Mike, does the cap on the bond that's in this constitute or equal a cap on liability?
Well, I'm looking for that amendment now, and it doesn't cap liability, but it caps the amount that can be required as a bond.
And does one flow from the other?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
But that's in Representative Hudson's amendment?
Correct.
Okay, that's not in Representative Ellis's.
No, Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't.
Yes. No cap in yours.
No, I would not.
Right, I think, and I think that's one of the problems that we had earlier testimony about. If you cap what somebody can ask to protect themselves from liability, that's, I think you're going to have other questions.
Not necessarily, but it may.
It may.
And I don't want to, personally wouldn't want to go that far.
Okay. All right. Well, Representative Ellis, we have a representative to start off, if you'd like.
Sure, please.
Sir, do you want to identify yourself?
Yeah, my name is Gene Burden, and I'm with Tesoro, Alaska, and I had a chance to look at the amendment. And on the surface, while it appears that it definitely addresses the intents to address the problem that we've got.
Sir, excuse me. Mr. Ford, if you could just stay with us. I know it's going to be hard for you to hear, but we might have another question real soon here for you.
Okay, well, I'll stand by.
Thank you.
Can you hear the witness, Mike?
I can.
Okay. I'll speak up.
He's just on down.
That's what you get.
Well, pick the receiver up there. Can you hear me okay, Mike? Okay. I guess the issue that we'd have to be concerned, or that I'd be concerned about is when you have a response action contractor who has no legal obligation to respond or to enter into an agreement, to what extent would this limitation preclude them from wanting to enter into an agreement with someone else?
That's one of the issues that I mentioned earlier. It do that exactly.
And I'd say that certainly to the extent that it would impede entering into these contracts, then that could present other problems that they might want to avoid.
But I understand exactly, and you may be right. You can't guarantee that someone will want to enter into a contract under these terms.
Representative Ellis?
Mr. Burden, could you put on the record for us what you, the feeling has, by some has been that Alyeska's requirement of the $1 billion direct action bond, given everything else that are the facts, is an unreasonable requirement on your company for its size and what you do in your normal course of business. What is a reasonable, and we know, you know, what your self-interests are, of course, but what would, in your opinion, be a realistic burden on your company for potential liability, you know, given what you know about the business? And
yes, the legislature last year wrestled with that in 567 when the financial responsibility regulations were modified, and chose to base it on the volume capacity of the tanker, at $300 a barrel of capacity of the tanker. And in that case, that puts our tanker in the neighborhood of $205 million. And recognized that that volume of directly actionable insurance is just not there, and set a limit that you have to come up with at least $50 million in directly actionable insurance if you haul crude oil in the state. That just applies to crude oil. I think they capped the non-crude at $35 million for financial responsibility. I would say that from our perspective, that the amount of financial responsibility required for a cleanup, a 72-hour cleanup obligation, should certainly not exceed that amount. And that's pretty much been our position as in our discussions with Alyeska from day one on this.
So your position is a $50 million direct action bond?
For financial responsibility not to exceed that imposed by the state of Alaska in last year's legislature. And I don't have it finessed down to the exact number, but that's in general what we feel like is a reasonable range, and that would take into account the difference in size in cargo tankers and that the current law, the law that goes into effect June 1, takes into consideration.
Thank you. Looking at the total scheme of things, and from your point of view as a provider of service for the people of Alaska that want oil and gas, how far can we push you before you close down and then the people go back to get refined products from the lower 48? Are we into a picture like that where you like it can only bear so much?
Well, it really becomes beyond just what the market will bear. It becomes, do we have crude oil to operate the refinery? If we don't have crude oil, it's not a market issue.
And it's not just Testoil, you're producing for other companies.
Yes.
There goes your dream on cheap prices,
huh? Cheap prices.
Yeah.
You're talking to the wrong guy.
That's what I'm thinking. There's only so much we can demand, and the people are going to pay for it eventually.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hudson. Might I ask, Mike, are you still on the line?
I'm here.
Okay. I asked you to develop the memorandum that, or the amendment that we were considering, in your letter you indicate that inherent in this approach is any approach that limits agreements between parties where one party provides service is that the limit can simply cause the services to become unavailable. Is that still your feeling, and do you believe that Representative Ellis's amendment is different so as to provide a better set of circumstances in order to not have the services go away than my amendment, for example?
Well, I think both your amendment, Representative Hudson, and Representative Ellis's amendment has this inherent problem, and that is, but if you impose a term legislatively on the parties, then the risk is that the people who would ordinarily enter into this agreement will decide, one of them will decide that it is not worth it, and the services may in fact become unavailable. So I think the problem applies to both your amendment, Representative Hudson, and Representative Ellis's amendment. And to how serious the problem it is, I think you really have to defer to people like Alyeska and Tesoro.
All right, thank you. Then if I might continue on, maybe Mr. Burton, do you agree with that assessment?
Yes, I do. I think that
what would happen if we adopt either one of these amendments, in your best estimation?
I could anticipate there being circumstances where certain response action contractors that don't have a legal obligation to provide services might not make the services available. Turner, I acknowledge is speculative, but that's as close as I can come. I think that is a possibility. I think the version that Representative Ellis has introduced is less obtrusive than the other version, and just in my opinion. But
if
Okay, Representative Greenberg.
Mr. Ford, can you hear me?
Yes.
I'd like you to look at the Hudson Amendment and the Ellis Amendment.
Yes.
It looks to me like the Hudson Amendment contains two sentences in the subsection D. And I'd like you to focus on the first sentence of the Hudson Amendment. That talks about the amount that may be required, and then the rest of these two amendments indicates a divergence in the way that that requirement may be met. In the one case by bonding, in the other case by these alternatives in subsection E to 4604040. My question to you is why the first sentence of the Hudson Amendment does not appear in the Ellis Amendment.
Because we're not in fact limiting the amount. All we're doing is allowing the person entering into the contract to show financial responsibility in any number of ways allowed under 040E. So we're not limiting the amount. They could ask for any amount they want, and the person that is providing the evidence of financial responsibility could demonstrate that under any of the forms allowed under 040E.
I understand what you're saying there, but then by the same token, why was it necessary to include it in the Hudson Amendment?
That was the request.
Oh, it was a specific request.
Yes.
Let me ask you, if that first sentence, if we adopt the Ellis Amendment, and that first sentence in there, was not in there, might it cause any problem? Might there be an advantage to putting a first sentence of the Hudson Amendment into the Ellis Amendment? I'm not necessarily suggesting it. I'm just wondering, as a matter of drafting and legal interpretation, whether you think there might be an advantage, and then I'm going to ask the folks from Alley ask the same question.
I think it's very difficult to say whether it's an advantage. It would be a change. It adds another element to the Ellis Amendment. Not only are you saying you can provide financial responsibility in any form, but the amount that's going to be required is limited to the amount specified under 040. So that's two elements combined into the Ellis approach. So you can certainly do that. It's not required, however.
No. I don't read the first sentence of the Hudson Amendment the way I think you just said. It looks to me, looking at that first sentence, like it may contain a term requiring insurance or indemnification or something in an amount that is in addition to the amounts under 040. It basically specifically states that the limitations, if any, in section 040 and regulations do not apply. It makes what is implicit in the Ellis Amendment explicit.
Let me add one more point, and that is the purpose of the first sentence is simply to set up a requirement that is explained further in the second sentence, or to limit the first sentence. In order to add a limitation in this way, it was necessary to impose the requirement in the first sentence. I understand your point. You could certainly add that sentence to the Ellis Amendment, and I'm not sure you have. I'm not sure that would cause any problems that I can see.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily advocating that, but I just wanted your thoughts. And then if we do have time, Mr. Chairman, I'll ask. I won't forget it. That's the end.
Okay. Any questions of the witness? Anything else?
Let's assume it was adopted. Can you layer your coverage to meet that $1 billion? I mean, if you can't even layer it, it doesn't make much sense.
Well, We presently have a total of $1.05 billion worth of insurance pool between the owner of the tanker and between us. So I presume that would continue to be available. $700 million of that is in P&I Club coverage.
We were told, and I'm not sure who I would ask this, but whether it's to you, sir, or somebody else, that there were two other companies that had been literally unable to meet this requirement and had dropped out of the trade. I'm wondering whether this language would help them as well, or would they still be unable to meet this requirement, if anybody knows.
I don't know. I really don't.
I'm sure I can find out.
The issue is whether Cove Shipping could meet it, and we don't know that.
I do believe that they had insurance similar to what our vessel operator, vessel owner had. I don't know any other details.
Does P&I insurance, is that readily accessible, or what's the normal procedure? If you were able to build up, layer up a total amount, including P&I insurance, is P&I insurance available, for example, immediately in the event of a spill or a short time thereafter?
Well, that's one of the concerns, is that the P&I club is an indemnity type insurance, and in order to access that, the party has to take the action against the insured party. And concern about the delay in access to that. It's designed to protect the insured against claims that arise out of a pollution incident. And in terms of the timeliness of the insurance response to a claimant, I don't know if I can speak to it any clearer than that. I know there are occasions where insurance companies don't pay as fast as parties would like to see claims paid, but.
Representative Martin? When Representative Dallas' amendment, we've had the introduction, we had the formal passing of it.
No, the amendment as amended is before us.
We're discussing. We're not asking if that would be late at this point. Did you say you have another amendment?
No. My three concerns, Mr. Chairman. The third was just the 1 year sunset, and
I'm with you on that one. I was making up.
I guess on the on this amendment, Mr. Chairman, you know, both what Representative Hudson and I have been trying to do from different angles, and this going a little further than mine, that all of that is, I don't know what they want to testify to it, but Mr. Burden has said that it's his belief that LASD will just not be the RAC response action contractor. We know that